So let me just maybe summarize a highlight from yesterday. So one of the highlights, I was trying to tell you about CFTs and how they fit in the landscape. So one thing that we found is that CFTs, in a sense, are universal objects. In the sense that they appear as canonical answers to a canonical question that you can ask of any quantum field theory, namely, what is the extreme infrared limit? So there's one, they appear as extreme infrared limit of quantum field theory, allowing for the proviso that the extreme infrared limit could be trivial, empty. So that's clearly one reason to care about them. They're canonical questions that appear in the study of field theory. Perhaps another important point that maybe was obvious, but I didn't perhaps emphasize it as much, is that any quantum field theory can be thought of as a perturbation or deformation of a CFT. So the idea is that take your theory that you like, a massive theory like the standard model. You can think of that theory as starting with some conformal field theory. Now, in practice, the conformal field that you start with is usually a free field theory. And we already went through the exercise yesterday that essentially all free field theories, much less free field theories, are conformal invariant. And then you can construct the theory that you care about by deforming, by adding operators. So given this point of view, a good strategy to learn about the space of all quantum field theories is first to understand the special points where the theories have extra symmetries, namely the conformal field theories. And once you understand those points well, then you are on your way to try to map out the harder problem of the most general quantum field theory that anyway can be thought of as a deformation from that point. So, what I want to say with this is that CFTs, even though they're special that they have extra symmetries, they play kind of a foundational role in the study of quantum field theory because of these two points and others that I will describe now. Okay. Another thing that CFTs are useful for that I briefly mentioned yesterday is that CFTs induce an ordering in the space of quantum field theories. So something that we can think about doing is start with a certain CFT. Call it CFT1, and now do the following operation. So we can start with the CFT1. This CFT will have a spectrum of local operators. That's one of the things that we will care about understanding. And now you can imagine deforming by a relevant operator. And then ask what's going to happen at large distances. Okay. Now, since the operator is a relevant operator, so we can think of doing essentially this operation. Okay. And now asking what happens in the extreme infrared again. Since the operator is relevant, it means that it grows as you go to the infrared. So that typically means that as you move, as you I mean, in the language that we use, as we integrate out from short distances to large distances, the coupling constant becomes larger. And then at some point, you cannot really use perturbation theory. The coupling constant is of order one, and you don't know what's going on in general. Okay. But by this thing I was telling you before, we know that this guy will have to. So this picture means this is the UV, high energy. This is the infrared. The infrared should be, but anyway. We know it's going to float to another CFT2. Okay. Now, precisely because this deformation is by a relevant operator, and there is no reason that the analysis, say below. So if you are very close to here, you may trust some perturbative analysis around this conformal field theory. That is essentially what happens in QCD. So in QCD, you can trust perturbation theory at very high energies. But if you go to lower energies, you cannot really trust it. Okay. But by these general arguments I was telling you, we know they're going to land on a CFT. Now, typically, what happens is something quite remarkable and quite beautiful in the inherently quantum mechanical phenomena is that this CFT that you get here may look like may look nothing like the CFT that you started with. So, for example, if this CFT was described by a certain gauge group and a certain number of bosons and fermions and whatever, the CFT you may get here may have a completely different gauge group, a completely different number of fields. It will look nothing like the one you started with. And that's kind of the kind of very intricate non-perturbative phenomena that quantum field theory can have. Yes?
What would be a relevant operator in this sense?
For example, a very typical example would be a mass term. Mm-hmm. Or I think in next week, when you study the two-dimensional conformal field theories, there is a large spectrum of relevant operators. And then you can study very intricate flows between a special class of conformal field theories. Very concretely, you can study there. You have a class of conformal field theories that are called minimal models. So these are theories that are conformally invariant that you can essentially solve completely without even writing down a Lagrangian, just using things that I will explain this week. And then depending on which deformation so there's a list of relevant operators in those theories, you can ask what happens when I deform by this operator, and the answer to this is known in very much detail. So the details of what you get here depends on which operator you turned on. And sometimes, yeah, so I could say many things about this, but maybe I should. And this picture that a physical system is described by completely different degrees of freedom is behind a concept that's called duality. So duality is roughly the idea that it's a physical system and has two completely different descriptions, but they're physically totally equivalent. And that's something that is very important both in high energy physics and in condensed matter physics. Okay, so, but generically, as I said, this is a hard problem because this is a non-perturbative problem. So now what I want to give you a baby example in which the flow from the ultraviolet, so where you flow from the ultraviolet to the infrared fixed point within a regime in which you can trust perturbation theory. So in principle, with enough muscle, you're able to compute anything you want to any desired accuracy. So what we're going to try to do is to generate an energy flow from one CFT to another one that's short in some sense. So, and this is actually very important because it played an important role in understanding critical phenomena from the quantum theory point of view. Nobel Prizes were given to this and so on. So I think I should say something about this. So also just to be more concrete because it will connect with things that I'm sure you've seen. So. And by the way, it's going to be also directly relevant to one of the paradigm CFTs that we will have in the back of our head when we try to understand CFTs in this course, which will be the study of the three-dimensional Ising model. So you're probably familiar with a two-dimensionalizing model. This is a model that's completely soluble. The three-dimensionalizing model is definitely not soluble, exactly soluble. And in fact, one of the things I want to lecture on by the end of the week is to use very powerful ideas, non-perturbative ideas of conformal field theory, to essentially compute with amazing accuracy all the critical exponents, all the interesting quantities that you want to know about the three-dimensionalizing model at the critical point. OK, so what is the Wilson-Fisher CFT? So the idea is the following. So we start with something that you surely have studied, which is the phi to the fourth theory. OK? No, so now the idea is very simple. So the idea somehow is to try to get a fixed point by, so what is a fixed point? Okay, so maybe it's something I should say again, is that a conformal field theory appears whenever there is a zero of the beta function. Because if there is a zero of the beta function, we have a scale invariance. Okay? So the basic idea of Wilson-Fisher, and there are generalizations of that that apply to gauge theories, where you study QCD, I mean, Young-Mills with a number of quarks, is that, so what do we know about lambda phi to the four? So what we know is that the coupling constant gets renormalized at one loop, and something that you probably computed in the course is that the beta function has a one loop correction, and it's of the order of some positive number. So it's, what the thing that's important about a scalar field theory is that the beta function is positive, okay? And it goes like lambda squared because the one loop diagram has two vertices, okay? So the way you compute this is you compute the running of the coupling at one loop. And at one loop, that's the diagram that matters. And it scales like lambda squared because there are two quartic vertices here. Okay. And this is positive. Just for orientation, if you did this for Young-Mills theory, you would get famously negative. So this is a theory in which the coupling constant grows towards the ultraviolet, not towards infrared. Okay. So now, how can we, and they were very clever, these two guys. So what is a way that admittedly sounds a bit kooky to construct a zero of the beta function? One way you can do it is by not studying the theory in four space-time dimensions, but studying the theory in four minus epsilon dimensions. So what we're going to imagine the theory in D equals four minus epsilon dimensions. There is nothing wrong with that. You can think of the dimension as a analytic parameter that you can study the theory in. Now, what's special in four minus epsilon dimensions is the following, is that this coupling constant, lambda, which was marginal in four dimensions, you're familiar with that classically it's marginal in four dimensions. If you go to a slightly lower dimension, it becomes slightly relevant. That's a typical thing that happens in field theory. If you decrease the dimension of space-time, the number of relevant operator increases, just because the dimension of the field decreases a little bit. And therefore, by taking more polynomials of the field, you can construct operators that are relevant, that have dimension less than d. So concretely, the dimension of this operator phi to the 4 will be slightly below 4. So that means now the beta function, so this was in d equals 4. Now, in d equals 4 minus epsilon, we already have a three-level contribution to the beta function. So you're going to have something that goes like minus epsilon lambda. So this is just the statement. So that's a three-level contribution. And this is just a statement that phi to the 4 is slightly below 4 dimensions is slightly relevant. And now, again, you can compute loops in this theory to leading order in epsilon. And at one loop, you're going to get exactly the same answer that you got in 4 dimensions. You're going to get A lambda squared. So now you make epsilon. OK, so now what you can try to do is to fish for a CFT by looking at the zero of this function. That's not hard to do. Let me just for fun put a 2 here. So this A will be the usual one loop factor. This will be like 1 over 16 pi squared, you know, the usual one loop factors that you get from Feynman diagrams. The details of this will not matter for what I'm talking about now. So now we can try to look for a zero of this beta function. So obviously, to find a zero, it's easy. I just put that to zero. And there are essentially two solutions. The solution is lambda equals zero, which is the free field theory point. So lambda equals zero, which is the free field, or sometimes it's called Gaussian fixed point. Gaussian because the action is quadratic. And then there is the interesting fixed point where lambda star is what I'm going to denote the zeros of the function. Lambda star will be, if I don't make a mess, epsilon over A, right? Maybe make a mess with a factor of 2. I don't need a factor of 2. OK. And this is so this point is the Gaussian fixed point. This is a point where you have a conformal invariant theory. And this is precisely the Wilson-Fisher fixed point or conformal field theory. Now, note that by doing this monkey business of going to 4 minus epsilon dimensions, I've found another CFT. So I started with a free CFT, which is the Gaussian fixed point. I deformed by lambda phi to the 4. And I landed on this Wilson-Fisher fixed point, Wilson-Fisher CFT. But the thing that I accomplished by going to slightly 4 dimensions is that the value of the coupling at the fixed point is arbitrarily small. Because if I make epsilon arbitrarily small, then the coupling constant at the fixed point is arbitrarily small. So I'm always in a self-consistent perturbative regime. Okay, so can be reliably. In an epsilon expansion. So in principle, in this CFT, I can compute anything that I want using perturbation theory. So this is a kind of a class of examples of RG flows that are short in the sense that the coupling between the ultraviolet fixed point and the infrared fixed point didn't get very much large. It still remains small, and you can be reliable. There are other tricks in the book to construct such theories. But roughly speaking, the idea is always the same. What you want to do is to be in a regime of parameters or degrees of freedom where you're canceling the leading term of the beta function with the subleading term. And making sure that the coefficient lambda star, when you compensate one term with the other, that the coefficient, the lambda star is always very, very small. And there are several ways of doing that. That's just the first and most famous and more important example, because this theory is directly relevant for the 3D Ising model, which we will come back in a few minutes. Now, so this blah, blah, blah I've been telling you, there's a useful way to picture this using an RG flow diagram. You may have seen this already, but I was told that I have to be pedagogical, so I'll be pedagogical. So this theory has two relevant couplings. It has the lambda coupling and it has the mass. I didn't write it, but the theory can have a mass. And if it doesn't have a mass classically, it will be generated by radiative corrections. So I start here, where everything is zero. This is the lambda m axis, if you wish. There are two fixed points here. So this will be the Gaussian one. And this will be the Wilson-Fisher one. And the statement is the following, is that this theory has two relevant operators. One is the mass and one is lambda. And what you do is you integrate out the flow equations that the theory has. So remember that beta of lambda is mu d mu lambda. So you can integrate this equation. And then you get this kind of picture. So okay. So you have your free field theory. You make a deformation by lambda. And if you tune your initial conditions in the right way, you'll be able to flow to end on this lambda star point. Okay. And that's how we usually denote RG flow diagram. So the arrow always means that you flow towards infrared. So that's just a different way that is useful to think about RG flows from one fixed point to the other one. Notice that something interesting happens. So around this fixed point, phi to the 4 was a relevant operator, so it pushes you away towards the infrared, right? It wants to grow. While at the sink of the fixed point, lambda phi to the 4 is irrelevant, because now if I'm at this fixed point and I deform by that operator, it's irrelevant with respect to the point of view. And that is there is a take-home message in life, that what's relevant for you, it's relevant for someone else. So this operator was relevant with respect to this fixed point, but it's irrelevant with respect to this fixed point. Okay. And historically, as I said, this was very important because for arguments of universality that I may touch upon, Wilson and Fisher argued that this conformal field theory that sits here, describes the universality class in the language of statistical mechanics of the critical three-dimensionalizing model. Now, of course, you could ask me, I was talking about d equals 4 minus epsilon, so epsilon was very small. How did I get to three dimensions? So that's where, at some point, there is an uncontrollable in what they did. This will not be very, very terribly important for us, because we're going to use a non-perturbative approach to studying these fixed points anyway. We're not going to rely on an ultraviolet definition of the theory. We're just going to study directly the CFT. Essentially, what they did is they did perturbation theory in epsilon to very high order. They did kind of a certain resummation of the perturbation theory, and then they did something brutal, which is just to plug the answer at epsilon equals 1. So you go from 4 to 3. But now, that sounds crazy, but remarkably, what they found is not only in extreme agreement with Monte Carlo simulations of the three-dimensionalizing model, but also with the experimental values that are measured for the critical exponents of the three-dimensionalizing model. I mean, the three-dimensionalizing model describes in particular the water vapor transition, the critical point of the water phase diagram, and ferromagnets and so on. So, but it's not completely satisfactory, because you're doing an extrapolation that cannot really justify it. In a sense, what I will describe later, the conformal bootstrap is a really reliable first principles non-perturbative way of extracting the same data that has no uncontrolled approximation. And that's why I want to talk about it. And this kind of non-perturbative approach, even though some of the ideas are very old, I mean, has only been used to, in a certain sense, solve the three-dimensionalizing model in the last few years. So it's a very recent development. Okay, so and there's something I want to say. Yeah, so this was an example of an RG flow from one CFT to another one. And I said that CFTs, I already wrote it somewhere there. Maybe not. That as I said, CFTs induce an ordering. So why is this useful? So imagine we know that this that so let's assume there exists an RG flow that maps you from CFT one, the ultraviolet, to CFT two in the infrared. Namely, this theory has some relevant operator that I can perturb the theory by, such that I land on this extra CFT. Okay, this is already a non-trivial statement, and for the reason I said that generically, this by the time you are here, the physics near here, from the point of view of the variables here, is very strongly coupled, because you did a very long RG flow. But then immediately you can, if this statement is correct, you can make an interesting statement. It tells you that there does not exist. I guess we do write it like this. An RG flow that goes in the opposite direction. So there is no RG flow that goes from CFT2 to CFT1. There is nothing you can do to this CFT by deforming by any operator that will give you this one, if this is true. Now, this is very powerful because, since I said, since these RG flows are non-perturbative, you immediately can rule out certain things. You can rule out. So in physics, a crucial art in physics is to guess. So you have to guess your answers, OK? So if you come with an answer, so someone very smart comes and says, oh, I found the answer to this problem. Well, if the answer is not consistent with this, he or she is wrong, OK? So you don't know what's right, but you know that's wrong, OK? And we use these kind of arguments very, very strongly all over, especially when you study non-perturbative dynamics that you cannot just solve by doing Feynman diagrams. More concretely, this can be made a bit more quantitative. We can assign to a CFT a height function . This has many names depending on the dimension. Let's call it C function. Actually, the C function is the name that's relevant in two space-time dimensions. And this is an example that I will discuss what this C function is later in the course. A C function C. And this is an intrinsic property. So C is an intrinsic property . It's like it's DNA, you know, it's part of its DNA. And it's something that I'll tell you how to compute. This appears in certain, in many places actually, but in particular it appears in the correlation functions, in the two-point function of one of the most, kind of the canonical operator that any quantum field theory has, which is the energy momentum tensor, okay? And this cartoon that I drew here, is quantified by saying that this quantity that you can associate in a CFT always has to be monotonic. So C must be monotonically decreasing. Under RG flow. So that means that induces an ordering. It tells you that C in the ultraviolet theory has always to be bigger than C in the infrared theory. Okay? Yes?
Is this something we observed when we were doing this kind of flow, or is there some greater way to explain why this is true?
Sorry, can you?
So you keep saying that we can flow in one way and not the other.
Yeah.
Is it because people try flowing in the other way?
No, no, because you can prove a theorem.
There's actually...
Okay. Yeah, you can prove a theorem. It's called the C theorem. Okay, so... And actually, in some versions of the course I give, I prove it. There are several proofs of this. I don't know if I'll... Maybe I will, maybe I won't. Yeah, but this is a theorem that follows from very, you know, apple pie and motherhood principles like unitarity, locality. Okay. After a few steps, you prove this. Okay. Now, the thing that's remarkable is that this proof was known for a very long time in two space-time dimensions. And in the last few years, it has been understood how to extend this to two and three dimensions. Okay. So there is, in every dimension, there is a natural candidate for C that has this property. And in fact, maybe I'll just say the buzzwords. So there is a quantity that has the universal, that has this universal property of being monotonically decreasing, and has to do with entanglement entropy, which is now a very popular and fashionable subject. But in two dimensions, and actually in even dimensions, this C function is something that has to do with, so in even dimensions, so it means 2, 4, whatever. C has to do with something that we will discuss, with conformal anomalies. Okay, so you see that we can make rather strong non-perturbative statements in conformal field theories that are really very powerful to constrain the dynamics that you may have in a strongly coupled system. So this is kind of a, if you wish, a way more of presenting the usefulness of conformal field theory from a very kind of a conceptual point of view. It allows you to understand more conceptually what the theory is. Now I have to discuss more. There are, of course, many other concrete, you know, more down to earth, if you wish, even though this is down to earth, because if you study some physical system, you want to know what happens at low energies. But I want to also discuss some direct applications of CFTs to the real world. Okay, so other uses of CFT. So historically, and then this is closely connected to this Wilson-Fisher work in the 70s, it's directly related to critical phenomena. In statistical mechanics. So it describes second order phase transitions. Where the correlation length goes to infinity. Okay? So you have some microscopic degrees of freedom that sit on, say, on a lattice. These lattices have a certain correlation length. And as you tune the temperature, the pressure, you know, whatever the experimentalist knobs are, you can tune the theory to hit a special point where the correlation length diverges. And that is a conformal field theory, because the correlation length is the length scale associated to the massive field theory. When the correlation length goes to infinity, you have no length scale anymore. So you have a conformal field theory. Okay, so what do you do in statistical mechanics? You the phase transition is characterized. So it's characterized by some non-analyticity. Of the partition function of the theory as a function of the external parameters of the magnetic field, the temperature, whatever your parameters are. And I want to study the theory near the critical point. Okay. And typically what we do is, which you probably have seen in the statistical mechanics course, there are the usual thermodynamic quantities that we define in the statistical mechanics, and we want to understand the behavior of those quantities as we approach the critical point, okay? For example, when T goes to the critical temperature, like in the Ising model, or, let's focus only on when there is only one parameter. So then, the canonical critical exponents that you can define are this, okay? So for example, you can have that the correlation length, as I said, diverges as you approach the critical point, and you can define this exponent nu. Let me just write them down, and then I'll say a few words. You can have the magnetization. So let's have in mind the Ising model, which is a model of magnetism. And we're going to study the behavior of these macroscopic quantities as a function of the deviation from the critical temperature and as a function of the magnetic field. Okay? Then the heat capacity blows up. By definition, in a second order phase transition, the heat capacity is the second derivative of the free energy, and that has non-analytic behavior. Then you have the susceptibility, which is some other second derivative. Yeah, now, so this is a second derivative with respect to the temperature. That guy is a second derivative with respect to the magnetic field. So the verges. And then you have the spin. So this will be like the local magnets that you have in your short distance model. And at the critical point, as I already emphasized several times and we will derive tomorrow, the behavior at the critical point has this power law behavior. Okay. So if you wish, the task of a statistical mechanics is to find some way of computing all these numbers. Okay? So you have how many? Five? Three, four? Six even. Something I want to say very quickly is that in the old days, before people realized the importance of a scale symmetry, people thought that these are all independent numbers, okay? But someone realized it was Kadanov. Okay, he used to lecture at Psi here. Unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago. He had a lot of deep insight into critical phenomena. The thing that was realized is that, before that, what people realized is that just phenomenologically, that all these different exponents obey certain linear relations. Each relation had a law, had a name, Rushmore law, whatever. Okay? Just like before Maxwell, each equation in Maxwell's equation had a name. This is a bit similar, so it had a name. But then what people realize is that actually the fact that all these laws are a direct consequence of a scale invariance. So whenever you have an extra symmetry in physics, you can explain more things than you could explain before. And all these laws that looked random and had no pattern were just a direct consequence of a scale invariance. Okay? So when all this is done, it means that all these numbers, I'm not going to write the formula because it's not very illuminating, can be written, are determined, are not independent, are determined in terms of two numbers, of nu and eta. Okay? And now from a conformal field theory point of view that describes this critical behavior, this nu and eta have a very beautiful interpretation as the dimension, scaling dimension of the relevant operators in the CFT. So if you have a way of determining the scaling dimensions of your operators in a CFT, you at one shot answer all these questions in statistical mechanics. Okay? Good. So maybe, are people familiar with the 3D Ising model, or should I talk about it a little bit? Okay, that means I will talk about it. Let me just say a few things to connect that language. Okay, I guess what I want to do is I'll connect that language of the 3D Ising model with the Wilson-Fisher language and also make a connection with this. So what is the 3D Ising model? So this is a model of magnetism in three dimensions. Unlike the, as I said, unlike the two-dimensional Ising model, this is not a soluble theory. In a sense, it's a long-standing problem to really solve for this theory. So this theory lives on a three-dimensional lattice. And you have spins at each side here. I don't know how to draw three-dimensional lattices, but okay, there is something coming out of the word. And the Hamiltonian is very simple. So you have some quantity that combines with the temperature to give a dimensionless parameter. And the Hamiltonian is very simple. So you have sides I and j. What you do is you sum over this funny notation I bracket ij means nearest neighbors. Of the spin of site I and the spin of site j. So essentially what you do is you sum, if you're here, you sum, there is a nearest neighbors interaction with all the adjacent spins. Okay. And you sum over all the lattice. Let's be for simplicity on the cubic lattice. You could put it in some obnoxious other lattice if you want. This will not matter when you go to the critical point. Okay? Now, this theory famously has this phase diagram as a function of the magnetic field and as a function of the temperature. So if you are at very low temperatures, the system wants to be ordered. It's energetically favored for the spins to be aligned in the same direction. So you get a magnetism. But depending on whether the magnetic field is slightly positive or slightly negative, the spins will align either up or down. Okay? So across this line, there is a first order phase transition. Where you have two vacua that, depending on how you change the magnetic field, get exchanged in relevance. Okay, that's the canonical way to think about first order phase transitions. You have multiple vacua that, as you move parameters in your theory, in this case the magnetic field, one becomes a minimum and so on. So for the magnetic field is negative, the spins wants to be down. If the magnetic field is slightly positive, they want to be up. Now, there is a critical temperature, which is the Curie temperature, where the theory becomes a CFT. So that's where you have the CFT. And to go there, you have to tune J to J critical. Okay. And then you have here, so this is the ordered phase. Ordered means that all spins are friendly, and disordered are they're unfriendly to each other, so they're each pointing in a different direction. Okay. Yeah, one point I wanted to make is that, of course, to reach a conformal field theory, okay, I have this picture here. You know, the experimentalist has to very carefully, you know, tweak at the knobs to hit this point, okay? So from this point of view, the CFT is something non-generic in the phase diagram. You have to tune parameters to get there. From the continuum field theory point of view, that's also manifest, because in order to hit this fixed point, I have to start with very particular initial conditions so that the flow line ends up here. If I change my initial conditions a little bit, I'm not going to go to the fixed point. I'm going to go to one of the disordered, one of the other phases, the massive phases. So this is quite generic. To get a CFT, you have to essentially tune the relevant operators to zero. Okay. Now, so now let's try to connect the physics of this to the lambda phi to the fourth theory. Now, so this theory has a very obvious symmetry. Can someone tell me what symmetry this Hamiltonian has?
Z2.
Has a Z2 symmetry? So. Okay, so can you tell me what happens to the Z2 symmetry in this phase and in this phase? So here the Z2 is broken, so I'll use this notation. And here Z2 is unbroken. Now, the claim is that this model, as you studied at larger and larger distances, can be suitably described by this Wilson-Fisher-Lagrangian, this lambda phi to the fourth with a mass term. Okay? I already said that once I tune my initial conditions, I can get to this particular fixed point. So from the point of view of the Wilson-Fisher description of this phase diagram, can someone tell me what do I have to do? What do I have to do to go to the disordered and ordered phase? How do I make the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, the Wilson-Fisher-Lagrangian has a Z2 symmetry also, right? So the theory is roughly speaking d phi square plus m square phi square plus lambda phi to the fourth. So what do I need to do to go to, say, the ordered phase? You know, if I make the mass square to be very large and positive, the vacuum of the theory has unbroken Z2 symmetry. Okay? So this would correspond to m square large and positive. How about the disordered phase? Well, how do I spontaneously break the Z2 symmetry of that model? You make m squared very large and negative, that's very good. So now the vacuum will, phi will have a non-trivial expectation value, and the Z2 symmetry will be spontaneously broken. So you see that this continuum field theory description of this lattice model captures in one shot a lot of the physics that a very kind of delicate analysis of the partition function of this model would let you to. Now, okay, so here, let me say maybe briefly a couple of things. Do I want to raise this? Yeah. Yeah, so I guess what I want to talk about now are so if you wish, what we've done is the following. We gave, if you wish, two different ultraviolet descriptions of a theory that flow to the Ising CFT. By tuning parameters, I can go to the Ising CFT. Now, the fact that there are many ways, I could have found other ways also to go to the Ising CFT. The fact that there are many ways that leave you to the same CFT is what in statistical mechanics call the idea of universality. And this universality not only appears in theory, but also in experiment. If you look at different systems with the same symmetries and you look at the critical behavior and you measure the critical exponents, you will find that systems that are completely different, like magnets and water, will have the same critical exponents. And that's just a statement that the physics here is essentially controlled by symmetries. Okay, and that's why there is this idea of universality. Okay. Now, the three-dimensionalizing CFT has an infinite number of operators. Okay, so technically, we call these primary operators. We'll see that in conformal field theories, operators come in families, and there is the one at the top, which is the mother, and then everyone else, we call it a descendant. Okay, so, but in this Ising CFT, there are only two, as Renata said yesterday, I made the important point that CFT is field theories in general have only a small number of relevant operators. So the Ising CFT has two relevant operators that control all these thermodynamics, two relevant operators. We call them, sigma and epsilon. Okay. Now the dimension of this operator is like 0.5 roughly and 1.5. Now we have an intuition of what these operators are from the point of view of the Hamiltonian here, the lattice Hamiltonian, right? Sigma is the spin operator. Sigma is the operator that is the image of the local spin, essentially. And epsilon is essentially just the energy, essentially this operator. Okay. And these are the two operators, the relevant operators in the theory. And I said these two numbers are the ones that determine U and eta and everything else. Okay. Now we could ask, how can we think about these operators from the Wilson-Fisher point of view? So let's now talk about Wilson-Fisher. So can someone make a guess to which operators would correspond to this and this from the Wilson-Fisher realization of the Ising CFT? And remember the rule, the simplest answer is 99% the right answer. So think of what operators can you write down given this Lagrangian? Sorry? Yeah, so phi will be correspond to the spin. What about epsilon? No. But phi cube has an interesting story that I was not, okay, no, it's not phi cube. One important thing is that epsilon is Z2 even, and phi cubed is not Z2 even. Sorry? Team you know. The indices don't match, I mean.
Yeah.
No, it's just phi square. I told you, the simplest is always the right answer. You also have a clear intuition about this. In order to hit the critical point, you have to tune the coefficient of the Hamiltonian, right? That's which is conjugate. So you have a parameter, which is this J, that's conjugate to epsilon. In order to hit the critical point, you have to tune that parameter. In order to hit the critical point, you have to make the Wilson-Fisher theory massless. Because if it were massive, it wouldn't be a CFT. So the operator conjugate, the operator that corresponds to epsilon is actually phi square.
Sorry, did you say that epsilon is the energy?
Is the energy in that sense, yes.
So why is it phi square?
Well, if you look at with the blurry eyes, sigma was phi, right? So the spin is phi.
Yes.
This is roughly like phi square. Okay. But I was trying to give a more physical reason for that, is that in order to hit the critical point, you have to tune the mass of the lambda phi to the fourth theory to vanish, otherwise it's not conformally invariant. And in the Ising model, you have to tune a J to J critical to go to the fixed point. So you're tuning you have to make one tuning, and so you have to make the operators that you tune. Okay.
Where's the extra 0.5 scaling dimension?
Sorry?
Where's the extra 0.5 scaling dimension?
The extra point?
Like if phi has 0.5.
Ah, okay, because so that's an example of us being perverted by free field theory. In an interacting quantum field theory, the dimension of phi square is not twice the dimension of phi. Sorry to break this to you, but it's... Yeah, so this also gives you a very important clue that in some sense, the actual Wilson-Fisher theory, when you do this crazy analytic continuation to epsilon 1, is in a very definite sense a strongly coupled theory. Because if it were close to free field theory, the dimension of this guy would be roughly twice the dimension of this guy, right? Because that's what you get in free field theories, and almost free field theory will be the same. But this is three times. So that means that the theory is not perturbative in any sense. It is perturbative at 4 minus epsilon, but not at D equals 3. Okay. Now, you ask a very good question about phi cubed. I cannot resist myself Because it leads to some interesting story that you could say, okay, what happens to, well, actually, you can first ask what happens to 5-4. Remember that I said that 5-4 near the Gaussian fixed point was relevant. But by this picture, by the time you get to the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, it's irrelevant. So that's why it's not in this list. So this 5 to the 4 is irrelevant. It's one of the infinite number of irrelevant operators the theory has. And let me just say that the phi cubed, actually, the phi cubed, is a descendant of phi. Remember I said that operators in conformal field theories come in families? And one thing that will become clear when we study systematically the representation of the conformal algebra is that phi cubed is not a primary operator but a descendant. And the reason it's a descendant is, what is the equation of motion of this model? The equation of motion of the model at the critical point is that the Lambertian of phi equals phi cubed, right? And the descendant operators of a conformal field theory are all operators that you get from a primary, which was phi, by taking derivatives. So phi cubed is a descendant.
John, I don't know what's a primary operator.
Yeah, so I'm saying that you could have thought that this operator would be here, but it's not. The physics of this operator, phi cubed, is completely determined by the physics of the operator phi. Okay, so, and again, what I want to teach now, so I'm giving kind of a historical way where people study deciding CFT. Now what I want to do in this course is to untie myself from ultraviolet definitions of this theory and study directly the Ising CFT. Now, this will be done without, so in order to do that, since as I was from this kind of argument, this theory is not weakly coupled in any sense, we will have to use kind of unfamiliar but not difficult non-perturbative techniques to extract the physics of this Ising CFT. So that's definitely one thing that I want to do. I mean, this is an object that it exists intrinsically, irrespectively of the ultraviolet definition. So let's find a way to study these guys directly. And that's the kind of the philosophical goal I want to take here. Okay, so now I guess I will. So this was just a long story to tell you that CFTs are important for such important subjects like statistical mechanics, critical phenomena. Let me just finish by giving you a few other examples that are, well, either directly relevant to nature or directly relevant to huge areas in theoretical physics. So we described here critical phenomena. So these are phase transitions that are driven by thermal fluctuations. Now, there's an interesting class of phase transitions that you can have, which are quantum phase transitions. That happen at zero temperature. Okay. And these transitions obviously cannot be driven by thermal fluctuations because the temperature is zero, but they're driven by quantum fluctuations. So typically what happens is the following, so you have some Hamiltonian. So you take a Hamiltonian, quantum Hamiltonian. It could be like a quantum spin Hamiltonian. And you look at the energy spectrum. So if there will be some ground state, then typically there will be a first excited state and there will be a gap. There will be a non-zero gap between the ground state and the first excited state. We call this gap delta. the jargon for this is the energy gap. Now, what can happen is that the Hamiltonian or your physical system, as a function of an external parameter, as lambda goes to lambda, lambda, lambda star, you close the energy gap. So that delta at lambda star is zero. Okay. So now you have a situation in which a gap Hamiltonian, quantum mechanical Hamiltonian, becomes gapless. And again, the theory does not have any length scale, and therefore it must be described by a conformal field theory. And I'm almost out of time, but let me just write an example of such a. So you can take just a one-dimensional spin chain, where you have spins sigma, the polymatrices at each side, and you write the following Hamiltonian. So now just this is just in one dimension. So you have the usual energy term that we described there, but now you couple this to magnetic, a transverse magnetic field. So the sigma I, x, y, z are the polymatrices. So again, the interpretation is that you have spins that want to align, but you subject them to a transverse, because this is in the x direction, magnetic. And the point is that this theory, the spectrum of this theory is gapped, but the gap closes as g goes to 1. You have a CFT. And actually, it's a very simple CFT that I'm sure you will study a lot, which is the two-dimensional free fermion. Okay. Now, another thing I cannot resist myself from saying is that CFTs enter in two other, I think, important subjects, measured by progress and by the number of people that work on them. I think you know where I'm going. So CFTs, you might have heard as coming next to another acronym called ADS. So the other one is ADS-CFT. So here the idea is extremely, at first sight, it sounds complete crackpot, but it's true. So the idea here is that you have some gravity in the some gravitational theory. Have you seen this already? Otherwise, I can skip it. That will be described by some Einstein term, you know, cosmological constant plus other things. This is in the semi-classical approximation. I'm cutting corners here, but there is certain gravitational theory, in principle, going beyond the semi-classical Einstein gravitational Einstein description, where, for example, curvatures can be large. And the idea is that any physics here that can happen here, like the formation of black holes, whatever, is described. So this would be some geometry that's ADS in D plus one dimension, that all the physics here is described by a non-gravitational conformal field theory in one dimension less that leaves, so you can think of this as like a can of soup. Gravity happens inside the can of the soup, and the CFT lives at the boundary of the soup, whatever, in the boundary of the can. And any question that you can ask in the bulk has, in principle, an answer to it from the point of view of the boundary. And the reason this is interesting is that there are many deep questions about quantum gravity that we do not have direct access to, that in principle, yet sometimes not in practice, the CFT at the boundary I'm being honest, okay? Can address. And the last one I will talk very briefly, I cannot help myself either, is the other subject where CFT is absolutely crucial is in the foundations of string theory. So, string theory is based not on particles, but on strings. And the point is that the dynamics of the string is described by a two-dimensional conformal field theory. And one thing that I still find, I mean, an amazing fact about string theory is that once you start studying these questions about what are the consequences of conformal invariants that arise from string theory. So if you, so conformal invariants is a fundamental principle of string theory. A classical ground state of string theory is a two-dimensional conformal field theory. And what I say is that the consequences of conformal invariants give rise to all the equations that you know. It gives rise to the Dirac equation, the Young-Mills equation. This is not put by hand. This is an output of two-dimensional conformal invariants. And more remarkably, Einstein's equations. And other things. So you see that inside the hood of string theory lies conformal invariants, and it predicts all the theories that we know and love. It has its own problems, but this is definitely an area where conformal field theory plays a huge role, and I guess next week you'll be some of it, and if you take the string theory course, you will see much more details of this. I guess I can stop for questions or just stop. You decide.